I'm Brandon.
And I'm Jesse.
We're Cannabis School. Having cannabis-infused conversations
with everyday people,
cannabis companies,
celebrities,
and your mom.
Welcome
to the Sesh.
All right, welcome back, everybody, for the Sesh. We have got a very good friend of ours on the podcast. Now, we look for things that are going to be able to enhance you in many different ways, from more of the plant medicine side to the spiritual side, and understanding exactly when you have cannabis, is it being grown with the best products available?
Or in the best way.
Yeah.
I mean, we learned.
Yeah, we learned a lot. We got to learn a lot through...
Terrible investment. Yeah. A good learning opportunity.
It was very expensive.
A very expensive education.
Not for me, but for him.
The most expensive education I've had to date.
Hell yeah, dude. I'm still paying back on my student loans, and that shit still is... yours is way more scary than that. But yeah. Without further ado, we want to be able to introduce our friend. Now, Nick, how do you pronounce your last name? I don't want to butcher it.
Nikolaev.
Nikolaev. Okay, that's easy enough. Nice. Yeah, so Nick Nikolaev from Rooted.
Rooted Leaf.
These guys are, I really want to go into the product, but I got to say, Nick, we really want to get a little bit to know you and our audience know you. So first thing, when I looked over everything, you and your wife, martial artists, what system have you guys studied?
We studied a Japanese style of karate, which is pretty old school and hardcore, you know, more traditional style. So it was not what you see nowadays with people just kind of playing tag. It was very much so a rough and full contact kind of martial art. So it developed good character, you know, in both myself and her. I started when I was 8 years old, and I met her when I was 19. And, you know, initially I was her sensei and she was a student, but over a couple of years we got to know each other really well, and that kind of led to us developing a really strong relationship outside of the dojo, and now we're married. So
dude, that's so
better. I was reading you just 6 months now. Congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, we got married last September, and had a chance to fly to Hawaii for our honeymoon, spend a lot of time there.
Nice.
Yeah, it was great.
So with the system that you study, is that Kyokushin?
It's related to Kyokushin. It's a brother art of Kyokushin. It's called Koikan. And the founder of Kyokushin studied directly with the founder of our style. They were effectively, they had the same sensei. It's very, very closely related to that. And then there's a couple of other martial arts styles that are also very closely related, but it's like a family or a group, a very small number of martial arts. And then everything else is kind of a derivative or an offshoot of those.
Yeah, I'm you're speaking to another. I've been studying martial arts since I was 7 years old. I'm 45. Lifelong. I mean, I did a bastardized version of Kenpo Karate when I was growing up, and then did Taekwondo, did Wing Chun for about 9 years, and then got into MMA styles like Muay Thai and all that one. But I did get to practice with a lot of Shotokan and Kyokushin Karate stylists. And it's exactly that. Like looking into your style, I know that style too. So hard, so brutal, but so like actually usable. It's not flash. It's just the body is hardened and it just gives you such amazing character. I mean, I could see that from the amount of detail that you put into your work. And that's just a direct correlation to that one, I would imagine so.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think I would be able to do the work I'm doing today if it wasn't for, you know, the life's worth of learning experiences that I had from the dojo and just learning how to overcome challenges and obstacles. I mean, my black belt test, you know, it takes about 9 years or so to get a black belt in our style. And my black belt test was 14 hours long, and it was spread across 3 days, and all 3 days that we trained, I ended up losing 10 pounds. Most of it was water weight, obviously, but I was still drinking 2 to 3 gallons of water and still losing 10 pounds of weight. So just to give you some context here, this is an opportunity to actually demonstrate and showcase how the will of an individual can go a lot further than the physical body wants to go. And so the goal or the purpose in that exam is to break you down to the point where you can't physically go on. And the only thing that you can do is keep believing in yourself and keep pushing yourself and mind over matter type of thing, you eventually break through to the other side and you realize that you're a lot stronger than you thought you were in all of the moments leading up to that point of physical failure. The goal is to encourage that point of physical failure so you can dig really deep and try to find what is beyond that point.
Man, that's amazing. That's
no,
one hell of a journey, it sounds like.
Yeah, I can completely relate. You know, when I grew up during an era where martial arts was truly martial arts, like the padding on the floor that I had was a concrete floor that was just painted on, that was smooth. And the protection is, you don't want to get hit in the groin, then don't get hit in the groin. It was truly to train you to utilize the martial art. And I agree with you. A lot of martial arts these days, you don't see a lot of martial artists. Their younger generation, it's more of just steered towards MMA, which is great in its own sense. But when you look at it, the traditional, very, very structured systems that are based on a lot of respect, not only for your instructors, but for yourself and for the system and for those around you. Like, it is there something to be said with it? It builds character. I wish that there were more schools that built character like that instead of being McDojos pumping out black belts every September when you signed up in March. It's just like truly like that, like you said, I mean, it took 9 years to get up to even test to that. The goal wasn't to sign up going, mom, dad, you know, I'm going to have my black belt and we'll have some cool display cases and you can brag to your friends. It's not that at all. It was truly about you and it defined who you are. So, and I remember those times where, I mean, you'd be training for, it just seemed like forever. And they're like, hey, cool. And then twice a year we'd have a camp and that's 3 days straight. It's just not like roasting marshmallows and finding some cool lizards out there. It's like, you're going to train from morning until we can't see. And even by the sea, it's going to be by the fire. So man, a lot of respect for that. That's says a lot about your character. That's amazing, man. I was super excited to see it. And it's like a family of martial arts. I can imagine when you guys, if you guys have children, it's going to be just, it's just part of your culture now.
Is that something you and your wife still practice together?
We do occasionally. I mean, it's not as much as we used to practice anymore. I'm really busy. She's really busy. but we still make time for it. You know, it's really important for us to kind of keep that connection, you know, alive and strong. One of the things that I find follows me regardless of what I do is that development of character. You know, the things that I learned and the way that I discipline myself and really the respect that I developed, not only for people surrounding me, but also for the style that I practiced and realizing how much hard work it actually takes. It kind of softens you as an individual at the same time that it strengthens you. So you become a lot more well-rounded. And I find that thing is something that is integrated into me in all walks of life. I mean, how I do anything is how I do everything. And it's that kind of approach that I think was really forged into me as a young child to make sure it doesn't matter if you're, you know, unloading the dishwasher or if this is like the make or break kind of, you know, opportunity in life, you have to give it your all in every single moment of your life. Anything that you do and everything that you do should be done with passion. And it should be done with the kind of vigor that, you know, defines what a black belt really is at you know, at the core of what it means to be, you know, the heart and soul of a black belt.
Man. So amen. It sounds like you take that heart and soul and passion into every part and every aspect of your life at this point. What led you, or like, what was the initial passion that found, like, that you found in Rooted Leaf?
Well, you know, there's an interesting story to be told about tea, I guess. You know, I'm a big tea connoisseur.
Yeah, I was hearing that.
Yeah.
Some like $30 a gram teas, $20 to $30 a gram teas. Do you actually drink that?
Yeah. You know, in some cases they do get very expensive. I think the most expensive tea that I have tried thus far is about $8 a gram. And it comes from a very limited production region. The total quantity produced is very small. And these are typically teas that are reserved for dignitaries that are traveling, like presidents.
Wow.
I think Richard Nixon and all the way up to Barack Obama, you know, they would get tea when they visited China for their political trips. They would get teas that come out of this particular garden and some of the surrounding regions as well.
Wow.
But you know, the types of teas that I prefer to drink on a daily basis, these are Phoenix Oolong. So it's a type of Oolong tea coming from a very small geographic region called the Phoenix Mountain Range. And they happen to have the oldest standing history of oolong production that's also remarkably complex and intricate. I feel like the manufacturing techniques associated with making these teas represent a 1,000+ year journey that humans have been having, you know, in conjunction, direct conjunction with nature. Part of it is informed by their breeding practices, which takes 20 to 30 years to select for the correct genotypes and the correct phenotypes. And then there's also this fine tuning of processing techniques that are applied. And in some cases, the teas may take upwards of 1 year just to finish making, and then they rest for another 2 to 3 years before they're actually ready to be consumed. So,
so the 1 year is, isn't even the curing process. That's just like, because the resting, I'm guessing, is the curing stage then that you're talking about. Or is that a separate, like, is that kind of inclusive altogether in the curing stage?
Yeah, you know, there's various phases to the manufacturing process. Initially, the initial stages could take anywhere from a few months up to maybe 8 to 12 months at most. And then that, you know, additional 2 or 3 years could just be the curing process to allow the tea leaves to kind of mature into the techniques applied to them. Because a lot of times you'll apply these techniques, and then for the next 6 months, the constituents of the leaf will continue to transform and change. And really what you're looking for is a particular spot along the progression of that transformation where you can drink the tea and you get kind of the maximum of, you know, all of its potentials.
Yeah. I just barely started roasting my own coffee beans, and it's kind of very similar in that stage of like all the degassing stage. And after that, there's like perfect stages of within the developing flavors of when to drink that. And every day is almost like different flavors as it develops and changes and progresses. So I can imagine with teas, I worked for Teavana for a few months in a really rough time period years and years ago. And that was like my first introduction to loose leaf teas. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is a whole nother world instead of just like cheap little tea bags from the store. Like way different level of
Do you ever go slumming on those types of teas, or you're like, no, my appreciation and level of consumption is it's a little bit higher?
Yeah. Do you ever go like poor kid chips with ramen and break it up, you know, and it's tea bag tea, you know?
not really, not these days. And you know, I try to maintain a fine balance between being a snob and being a connoisseur. I guess it's like a really fine line between the two of them. But you know, as far as the overall price points, I mean, I drink teas that are inexpensive, that are affordable for daily consumption, but I also try to seek out teas that are relatively unique. One example would be like in the Phoenix Mountain region in general, there's mother trees that are several hundred years old. And the way that they're propagated is farmers will come in and take cuts. Very limited number of cuts get propagated forward. But when you take those cuts and you populate, you know, another garden full of those cuts, you may have to wait 20 to 30 years before the tea tree is old enough for it to be harvested and processed and picked. So, you know, if you can get the mother trees, those are very expensive because there's only one tree of those in the entire world. They happen to be several hundred years old, and the total amount of tea produced from them oftentimes is less than 10 pounds per year. And I would say, you know, unless you know somebody in the innermost region and who has a very strong network with multi-generational farmers, it's very difficult to access authentic mother tree productions, and they can cost upwards of $5 a gram, if not more. I think the oldest, if I recall correctly, back in, I think it was 2006 or maybe it was 2016, but the oldest tree on Phoenix Mountain, which is around 700 to 800 years old, the tea leaves were auctioned off, and I think they sold for $500 a gram.
Whoa. Holy cow.
Have you experienced any of that before?
Nothing like that. And to give you guys some context, I need about 7 grams to make one pot of tea. So $500 times 7 gram, you know, it's a little bit too
expensive pot of tea.
Right now, that's some Elon Musk tea. Afternoon tea, right? He's like, that's I guess right. I'll have some that's of this right. tea.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's something that you have to kind of become soft wired for. You got to drink a lot of tea in order to appreciate the kind of nuances and subtleties that really old trees can convey, because it's not, some of the flavor profiles aren't quite in your face. I mean, for some of these teas, don't get me wrong, you can smell the tea from 15, 20 feet away, and it's like this explosive bouquet of like flowers and fruits, and it's just the most amazing thing. But a lot of the old trees, they're a lot more subtle. They won't punch you in the face, but they'll creep up on you like an edible you weren't feeling an hour and a half ago. And then all of a sudden, you're just like, whoa, this is crazy. It definitely has that kind of psychedelic aspect to it.
So with that said, I mean, you know, on our show, we completely understand what you're talking about. You know, after years of consuming cannabis on a level of not like, let's get high, bro. Like, it's very about what's the intent that we really have for this plant and the respect we have for it. And over the years, like, it's not just burning plant to us. Just like, it's not just gray Earl tea for you. It's, you can taste the nuances and you can really understand, even through the quality of it, like what that growth cycle must have been like, what kind of care went in and the nutrients that were given to the plant in order to produce the highest quality that you're getting at that moment. Because now, like, we're just joking around about slumming and having some ramen style, you know, tea bag, which, I mean, yeah, affordable is totally, you know, you're using affordable tea, but I'm saying, like, over there, it's in a box. We don't know how long that's been sitting on a shelf or in a warehouse. Like, all these things take into account. Like, I found cannabis in a little tube that I'll put, even airtight, it'll be there for over a year. It'll be okay, but it's still not appreciated as when you really know the steps that it's gone through. And so when you talk about, I can pick up on subtle tones with, like, these really older teas that are very complex, and it creeps up on you like an edible. When you said that, I just started laughing in my head.
Yeah,
that's like, you know, we know that feeling, and to experience that through tea, that is very, very unique. And in that way where you just have to know. We have so many different people that listen to us, from cultivars to your end consumer, and it's appreciated. It really is appreciated. And that's where, you know, I think about what you are doing now and the complexity of going into it. Brandon, you know, what are some of the things? Because, I mean, I know you got, but so our audience knows a lot about Brandon's past as far as getting into the cultivar side of cannabis and understanding that. But I know you got a lot of questions based on that.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Explain to the audience a little bit about Rooted Leaf, what it is that Rooted Leaf is, what it is that they do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Rooted Leaf Agritech is a manufacturer. We make carbon-based fertilizers. We've been in business since April of 2019. And the idea for Rooted Leaf initially came around as kind of a combination of a variety of different experiences that I had in life. The first was obviously tea, like we just talked about. And then I started fermenting tea and making kombucha. And I realized that during this fermentation stage and process, there was a remarkable amount of change that occurred, you know, between the parent material being tea leaves and perhaps cane sugar and water. You combine the three of those, let the microbes do their thing, come back 10 to 14 days later, and it's a completely different product altogether. It got different physical properties, different chemical properties. So I became really intrigued by this process of transformation, how microbes in particular are capable of changing things around. So at that time, probably, you know, 2010, 2012, I had a small kombucha brewery and I was exploring this. And then I ended up getting hired at a company, a chemical manufacturing company here in Washington State. And I worked there for maybe a year or just over a year. And my job there was to help them do some formulations work. So I went in and I kind of took a look at some of the recipes. I didn't have much experience in industrial chemistry at this time, but I had a deep passion for it and an underlying understanding on the fermentation side, at least, of how transformations in chemical systems can occur. So I was really intrigued to explore this, ended up spending a little bit of time there and realizing in terms of synthesis chemistry and making stuff, order of operations is just remarkably critical. You can take 10 different ingredients, combine them 100 different ways, and 99 of those ways will break. And the one final way that actually works, you know, correctly, produces a product that's stable, that is a combination of some very detailed steps. You know, like, some of these steps can involve particular temperatures. You know, you have to add this product into that product. You can't go the other way around. Sometimes it's a temperature thing and it's a time in terms of rate of addition thing. So there's all of these different steps in the process that most people would overlook, right? It's just as simple as adding ingredient A into ingredient B, but that couldn't be further from the truth. You have to understand all of the physical properties of what is A and what is B, and then try to figure out how did they interact with each other. Do you want that reaction to happen very slowly so that you can create a very consistent product? Or do you want it to happen very quickly, in which case it might break entirely and the formula is no good anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of experience.
Altered, like at the different temperature, you know, is it, then you have a whole different compound you're working with too.
Exactly. Exactly. So time, temperature, rate of addition, pH, there's so many different properties to measure that ultimately have an impact on the creation of this product. So I did that. I became really inspired. And then in 2014, Washington State legalized the recreational cannabis industry. And so, you know, at this time now I have experience with fermentation chemistry and I've got experience in industrial chemistry, synthesizing compounds and doing a little bit of synthesis work. And I just felt like it was a natural fit for me to transition into the cannabis side of things because I've been a passionate cannabis enthusiast for a very long time. Initially going back to the medical days here in Washington, about 2008 or 2009, I started to get involved a little bit on the cultivation side, although I was never really a big grower. And, you know, I just started meeting people, kind of exploring the plant a little bit more and realizing that everything that I was passionate about with fermentation chemistry was mirrored in the cannabis plant. And I always had this burning underlying passion to kind of explore, you know, how did the plant get here? How did we end up to, you know, in a spot where the profile of terpenes and cannabinoids is what it is, and looking at some of the underlying mechanisms behind that. So that, you know, led me about 2014, 2015 to start looking at plant nutrition. And ever since then, you know, we've been doing this work, which we now describe as a carbon-based fertilizer. Obviously, when we initially started, it was more difficult for us to characterize what exactly we were doing. And fortunately, we've learned a lot along the way. And now we're in a position where we have a pretty good understanding of how this technology works, what exactly sets it apart. And I'm super excited to talk to you guys about that.
That's amazing. Yeah. So take us through, say, like your carbon-based fertilizer. Say we have a plant. Say we have Blue Dream for those growers at home. Very simple to grow, very high yielding. A lot of those beginner growers might start with something like that. Introducing, say, your carbon-based fertilizer versus a normal fertilizer, what would you see as far as like structure changes or growth or even like massive benefits from the carbon-based versus that other standard?
From what I understand, you have a great analogy by using a car all the way down to its chassis of how your actual, like, take us through that, because it's probably by far the best explanation of it, because it's really easy to break it down and you understand that it's everything comes from the nutrients and how it's actually going to build a very strong platform, if you will, right? So real strong yielding, high yielding plant. Take us through that.
Yeah. And I guess the underlying premise of a carbon-based fertilizer and the reason it works so well specifically for cannabis is because most of the compounds that growers are seeking to produce, the monoterpenes and the sesquiterpenes, and obviously the cannabinoids, those are roughly 80 to 90% carbon by weight. In fact, all of the monoterpenes like myrcene, pinene, limonene, they're 90% carbon by weight, and all of the cannabinoids are 80% carbon. So in reality, if you want to get more cannabinoids, you want to get more terpenes out of your plants, you really have to try to figure out a way to feed them more carbon. And now traditionally the way that this has been done is to inject CO2 gas into a room that's sealed. And growers who have done this before, all of them will attest to this. As soon as you increase the CO2 concentration to the plants, they start responding much better. They increase their yield, they increase quality. There are morphological differences that change, such as the surface area of the leaf becomes a lot bigger. The plants just grow faster. They seem to transition between the various stages a lot faster. And the thing that I want to point out here is that carbon is a macronutrient for crops in terms of how much is taken up. We oftentimes just look at nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, the CalMag, micronutrients, so on and so forth. But these elements actually represent a very tiny percentage of what plants will ultimately accumulate. In fact, you could take all of the NPK, CalMag, silk, you could take all 17 elements that you'll find in a conventional salt-based fertilizer, take that number, add them all together, multiply that number by 5, and the plant still has accumulated more carbon than all of those. So it really casts things into a different light to say, well, the thing that plants are trying to do more than anything is utilize all of these elements like nitrogen, for example, as a means through which they can capture more carbon. And as I've built out this analogy of a car engine over the past couple of years, it's something we've been working on for a few years now. And I feel like the analogy is at a really good place now where we can kind of blow it up a little bit, take a look under the hood and see what exactly is going on. one of the high level examples I'll give you guys is that 90% of the nitrogen that you apply to your plants, actually more than 90% of the nitrogen, becomes either chlorophyll, which is that green pigment, or becomes an enzyme called Rubisco. And Rubisco has one job, and that's to take CO2 out of the air and convert it into a plant available form of a sugar, effectively. So it's the very first enzyme involved in this dedicated step. And it's a little bit ironic, in my perspective, how most of the nitrogen you apply towards your plants actually goes towards capturing carbon, right? Because chlorophyll takes light energy. What's that light energy used for? Photosynthesis. Rubisco operates to take CO2 out of the air using that light energy to create sugars. And if you become deficient in nitrogen, one of the first places that you can look is towards the leaf surface and see if it's yellow, for example. It's an indication that the plants are deficient in chlorophyll. They don't have enough of that green pigment. So it's ironic that a deficiency in nitrogen is actually the exact same thing as a deficiency in carbon. The plants have a bottleneck in that carbon. So this is a high level, easy to understand type of example, wow, specifically as it relates to nitrogen.
That's incredible. Yeah, because even like we joked at the beginning, I made this horrible investment or expensive education. And in that, I read the Oaksterdam University's Growers Handbook from front to back, just because it was like, oh, shit.
You just invested a bunch of money. Yeah.
Like, I need to really, like, I knew at least, okay, in my mind, I feel like I knew nothing about cannabis. In relation to a lot of people, I probably knew a lot about cannabis. But that wasn't anything for me in relation to, okay, I just dropped $100,000. I need to figure out what the hell I'm putting this money like into and really understand it on every level that I can. And so I sat down with that and I read it and I was like, even just that discussion of like nitrogen and like all the oxygen, every mineral, every like thing that goes into that plant. But when you're understanding that the real like end goal in that really is just changing a lot of that to carbon or really pulling in more carbon, and even on understanding on a basic level, like looking at trees and then looking at the cannabis plant, and cannabis pulls out like four times more carbon than like trees, isn't it? So like that little plant is reducing or pulling in massive amounts of carbon. So wouldn't like that sounds like it is its end goal. Like mm-hmm. feeding it more carbon. So having a fertilizer that is based or, you know, in that has more of the nutrients that it's actually looking for, that mm-hmm. seems like a supercharged soil almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a little bit, there are some differences, which we'll get into a little bit. But the idea is that, you know, we understand plants, all of the activities that plants participate in revolve around capturing carbon or storing carbon or somehow utilizing carbon, whether it's taking in energy from the sun to make sugars or doing something as specific and nuanced as making a monoterpene out of the accumulated pools of carbon. And you're right when you say that there's some reduction that has to happen because CO2 in the air is in an oxidized form. It's got the oxygen molecules attached to it. The plants don't really care about that. Really what they're trying to do is break the oxygen apart from the carbon and then use that carbon. And in this process of converting the oxidized forms of carbon that are in the air into the reduced forms of carbon that are perhaps the monoterpenes, right? Because monoterpenes are just carbon and just hydrogen. They have no oxygen inside of their structure. Some of the oxygenated ones do, obviously, but you know, the thing I want to try to convey at large is that plants use the power, the reduction power generated through photosynthesis to capture that carbon and then to store it and then to utilize it for certain things like the biosynthesis of secondary metabolites. So really what we've done is take a carbon-centric approach to creating fertilizers to say, look, every element that we have in our product line has to be fundamentally connected to carbon, because then when it's delivered into the plants, there's no energy expenditure that's required. We're doing the chemical reduction of that carbon through fermentation chemistry and then creating chelates and complexes that deliver those minerals like the NPK, calcium, and magnesium in the most ideal forms. And one of the examples I can give you guys for that is when we manufacture our calcium chelate, we're fermenting orange peels, because as everybody knows, and most growers will tell you, calcium is a component of thick cell walls. So if you have more calcium, the plants form thicker cellular structures. Well, if you look at an orange peel, it's just basically a really, really thick cell wall. And it's full of pectic acid residues, which, as it turns out, all plants utilize pectic acid to complex calcium, shove that into the cell wall. And then that's their, that's one of the bases for their cell wall components. by fermenting the orange peels, what we're doing is taking those pectic acid residues that are naturally present in very high concentrations and then running a chelation reaction with calcium so that when we're delivering that calcium chelate to the plants are taking up something that they recognize. It's biologically relevant for them. They look at the calcium, they look at the pectic acid, and they have mechanisms internally, enzymes that can attach directly to these molecules and make use of them right away. There's no energy expenditure. The reduction power is already stored in those bonds. So when plants take up our nutrients, they experience a net gain in energy, which leads to an increased productivity and yield. Even if you don't have a sealed flowering room, you don't have to have a sealed flowering room anymore, because we can put as much carbon as is found in about 5,000 ppm of CO2 in the air, but inside of a liquid medium. So we're loading carbon from the inside out rather than the outside in. And the focus now for us becomes, how do we increase transpiration potential for the plants? Because the faster we can get the plants to take up the feed water, the more carbon they're ultimately going to be able to access. And so this transpiration pump is really a key focus of the carbon-based chemistry in our products. That's cool.
Yeah, there's like trying to match the certain levels of everything so that it can grow at its most optimal form, basically.
So as a layperson, like I'm wondering, like, does that like increase the growth cycle, the time?
Does it shorten it, you mean?
Yeah, does it shorten it?
Yes, it can. In most cases, we've seen a decrease in the overall time spent in flowering without a decrease or a reduction in quality or yield. And I often attribute this to a lot of stressors that get in the way of plants performing at their peak levels and their optimum performance. It's just a natural law in biology that there's always going to be one limiting factor. There's always going to be something that the plants need a little bit more of to maintain an equilibrium. Yeah. It doesn't matter how much nitrogen you have if you're deficient in phosphorus.
Yep.
You can add as much nitrogen as you want. It will never correct that phosphorus deficiency. But when you add in more phosphorus, all of a sudden, that doesn't become the limiting factor. Now, instead of phosphorus, your limiting factor may be magnesium. And so you have to look at adding magnesium. And so all of these things have to be very tightly coordinated together and then delivered to the plants progressively so that they don't experience bottlenecks that are reasonable. I think if the bottleneck itself can be the intensity of the sunlight or the ability of the dehumidifiers to pull moisture out of the air, that puts the stress on the external factors that are
the environment. Longer the plant and that. And that's what I initially learned through all of that study was like, oh shit, this guy who's growing is not doing anything of this. There is nothing that's being tracked. And I was like, what are we doing this? What are we doing this? What are we doing this? What are we doing of this? And the guy's like, crickets. So,
yeah. And I think about that because like when you're talking about decreasing the time for full yield, but on top of that, I'm just thinking about like, you're taking a lot of the complexities and you're being able to utilize all of the nutrients and the waters that are going in there. So a big problem with a lot of growers is the usage of water. Like when I got involved, he made the investment and he's like, hey, I don't think these guys really understand business talk. Can you talk to him? And when I just started
business at all,
we brought him
on as like the CEO. Thought it would be a good idea.
Well, because I came from the supply chain and manufacturing world at that time. And so I was like, okay, well, cool. I need to know your water usage, your power usage, you know, what's your nutrients you're putting in the ground? What's the cost on your nutrients? And where are you getting it from? Is it a trusted source? At the time, there was a grower out there that they had to recall a bunch of their cannabis products because everybody started getting hepatitis.
Yeah, they did some horrible thing out there. Yeah, and it was like, what the crap?
Who knows what they were using for fertilizer at that time? And I think that's a big misunderstanding for many growers, especially when they're getting into it. And even some of the larger grows, they kind of treat it like it's just tomatoes and you can just use whatever you get over at Walmart and saying, hey, yeah, that's going to give me the best yield. But when you were talking about the color of the leaves, I remember one of those times where we got pictures back from this grower that he invested into, like the yellowing of the leaf, and they're like, oh, it's probably just too close to the light. And it's like, it just like when you talked about that, it's literally like foundation medicine within us humans. Like if we are deficient in one thing or another and we run a lab report on it, it'll tell us like, hey, you're low in testosterone, you're low in vitamin D, you have low sodium. I mean, And those things matter, and adjusting them accordingly helps to level things out. And it sounds like this is like a super dense nutrient food that plants are able to just get the most out of. And you said you have a line of products, is that right? For different types of plants, would that?
Yeah, we have a full product line. There are 9 distinct formulations, but there's 8 products. So one of them is a 2-part base nutrient, and they're all incredibly fine-tuned specifically for cannabis, but they work phenomenally well on other crops as well. It just, the use rates may change and the timing of application may change, but the form factor of those products represents the most biologically relevant form of those elements that are inside of the bottle. Like I mentioned with the calcium, for example, fermenting the orange peels in particular lets us really deliver basically like a 99% complete cell wall for the plant. It doesn't have to do any work anymore. All it has to do is take it, and it actually releases energy within the plant, because once the production power is opened up in the plant, that powers the plant's processes. So in a strange way, the electrons that flow through the electron transport chain during photosynthesis are actually identical to the ones that are captured in our products. And so what we've seen is also that there's a decreased need for high light intensity as well, because the electron energy, which is captured in the form of reduction power, is stored in the chelates that we make. It's physically present in those molecular bonds as potential energy. And then plants have these enzymes. They've got these tools and the ability to go and maybe cut up some of those compounds, break them down into simpler compounds. And it's during the breakdown process that the potential energy becomes released as kinetic energy. And that drives metabolic processes that typically the plants would have to absorb energy from the sun in order to power. But now we have this advantage of them being able to actually take it up directly from the feed water and access the power of the sun as it's stored through the fermentation chemistry and delivered through the actual feed water. Wow. I think it's worth mentioning too, like you were just talking about, you know, plants and car engines are actually remarkably similar in their underlying mechanistic principles. In order for a car engine to produce horsepower and torque, you need spark, you need air, and you need fuel. Those are kind of like the basic components. And you start to build out a system around that with the intake and the exhaust. And you start looking more specifically at like the strength of the spark carried through the plugs themselves, the amount of air and fuel, and really the ratio between the two of them to prevent the engine from running rich or running lean or dry, I should say. Plants are actually exactly the same way. Their spark is the sunlight. Their air, quote unquote, is the carbon that comes in from the air. And then their fuel is water, because as we all know, plants take up water. They split water molecules apart. They convert them into electrons and protons, which each get funneled down to their respective metabolic pathways. And then molecular oxygen, which we learned in kindergarten, plants breathe out, humans breathe in, and we release the CO2 back to the plants. So this is the kind of underlying principles. And obviously, car engines producing horsepower and torque, plant engines actually produce primary and secondary metabolites. It's a really good way of thinking about horsepower and torque. And what is the measurement of the flow of power in a car engine? Well, it's horsepower and torque. And the same measurement applied to plants as primary and secondary metabolites. And for cannabis,
would that come out with cannabis as like terpenes and cannabinoids?
Yes, yes. The terpenes and cannabinoids represent the flow of power through the plants. These are very high energy molecules. They require a lot of energy, which is exactly why you need high light intensity and direct light intensity. No one ever won any cups or got any awards as a result of shade growing a plant under very low light and only watering once a week. You know, the intensity associated with these molecules is captured in the rates at which they are accumulated. And the more intense your grow environment, in other words, the more intense your air, spark, and fuel are, the higher the performance that you're going to achieve.
Yeah.
In other words, the more cannabinoids and terpenes your plants will be able to.
Because as long as your ratio matches and it fits, you can increase that, you know, spark, gas, and fuel. Like you can increase all of those as long as the ratio is perfect and it matches what that plant needs. And it sounds incredible, because what it sounds like to me is this, this fertilizer basically allows the plant to not work as hard in some aspects and put more of its energy into growing bigger and probably healthier, meaning that it's going to fight off more things, I would imagine, naturally, just because it's no longer putting so much energy wasted in trying to convert or do these things that are not necessarily necessary processes when they have the fertilizer and the nutrients, you know, at the correct ratio.
I mean, you're 100% right about that. Just like a car engine operates, plants are very similar. So imagine you crank up the light intensity in your grow room, but you don't increase the strength of the fertilizer. The plants will quickly become deficient. Let's say you increase the light intensity and the fertilizer load, but you don't increase the CO2 concentration. Same thing. Now there's a bottleneck there. Yeah. Now let's back up one step. Suppose you did not increase the light intensity. What if you just fed them a lot heavier and you cranked up the CO2? Your results would also be limited because there's not enough spark that's there to combust this combination of stronger feed with higher
access.
You're
going to burn rich. You'll run rich or you'll run lean. So
exactly.
Some one way or the other, your end product won't be ideal because it won't ever be that perfect level if those ratios don't match. So that's incredible. I think.
Well, yeah, and we know what he was talking about with the fermented orange peels and what that's ultimately doing by being able to give it more calcium rich, strengthening the plant. Like in my mind, it went all like Marvel, like how the cells are like dividing and everything like that when he was describing that, and then thinking about the calcium is creating this like stronger exoskeleton to really protect the plant from a lot of the things. I mean, and that's kind of a question I have there. Is this through this nutrient, through your product, is this able to help the plants be stronger and being able to fight off against like pests?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two halves of that approach. One is just treating carbon like a macronutrient, because as it turns out, when plants have additional substrate pools, they can afford the production of certain molecules. I actually created the analogy of a bank account, a chemical bank account. You know, imagine you go to the store and you have $10 to spend. You're trying to get a variety of ingredients to make your sandwiches. So you have to buy your bread, you have to buy your meats, cheeses, sauces, a little accoutrements here and there. Plants are the exact same way. They too have reduction power that they build up and put inside of a chemical bank account. And they use that reduction power much like we use dollars, except instead of buying, you know, sandwiches and ingredients for sandwiches, they're trying to effectively access minerals and nutrients out of the soil. They want to convert the nitrogen, so they have to spend a certain amount of energy on that. They need to fight off a disease pressure, so there's a huge tax that's placed on their bank accounts, if you will. It's very expensive for the plants to deal with certain types of disease pressures. And if you increase the substrate pool available for them to spend, they can start to have all of these expressions that they typically wouldn't, because they don't have enough money. They're being taxed by having to process too many nitrates or too many sulfates or too many synthetic fertilizers. All this stuff robs the plants of their energy pools that they progressively build up throughout the day, which is why when you deliver our products, because the reduction power is captured in those bonds, the plants can automatically utilize that to ward off disease pressures by producing secondary metabolites with almost no tax. I mean, it's like you work, you know, through the day and you put a certain amount of money in your bank account, let's say every week or every month. Imagine if someone came in and just gave you an extra $1,000 a week and said, spend this on whatever you want, but it has to improve the quality of your life. It has to give you a stronger structure. It has to give you a better foundation. It has to smooth out the rough bumps for you in your life. This is exactly what happens with the plants. You give them the additional reduction power and they are capable, and they certainly do generate more compounds. But on a more microscopic level, the basis of this sort of affects all plant expression down to the DNA. So we actually see gene expression increase significantly, not only the overall concentration of terpenes and cannabinoids being higher, but also the breadth and the depth. And we see these terpenes come out in test results that are typically very rare and very conserved in cannabis. So now there's this additional layer of complexity because the plant has this extra energy. So it says, well, let me turn on this pathway. And now there's this synthase enzyme that's responsible for producing a terpene that typically is just kind of in the background hanging out, doesn't get much attention, doesn't get much activity. But in an environment where the plants have access to a surplus of energy, now you have all these other ancillary enzymes coming in, and they start participating in the process of taking the substrate and creating a compound out of it. And that's where we start to see the increase in the breadth and the depth of the terpenes. I mean, a huge difference in the overall flavors and aromas that are captured in the plants, and really their ability not only to resist disease, but also to hold a really long cure and a really long shelf life with no degradation to the terpenes or cannabinoids whatsoever.
Wow. That's when, I was curious with that, because as you were talking about that, it really just sounds like you said a wider expression of terpenes and cannabinoids. And for everyone who understands the entourage effect, that truly just means like a better experience. So, living in Washington, do you grow your own at home? Or do you grow your own, maybe even commercially?
Not anymore. I like to live vicariously through other people's gardens. I mean, I have a small garden in my backyard. Every year I'll grow like fruits and vegetables, and I have a chance to see how our products work there.
Yeah.
But it's been a couple of years since I've grown cannabis. And
do you have friends who are utilizing your soil that you... I'd just be very curious, like the experience of a side-by-side comparison, because I would wager that products grown in rooted leaf would have a much better experience, even from, like, if I were to pop two seeds, one pot next to each other and have one standard, like, soil or whatever I'm using on one rooted leaf, I think that entourage, like, I think it would be a much more complete experience with that rooted leaf one. I'm just curious, how often, like, do you get to sample that?
Yeah, we're fortunate enough to have friends that are local to us here in Washington State that we do a lot of really good work with. A couple of these guys I've been working with for a few years, and they've definitely provided very valuable feedback and information that initially is a little bit theoretical. I'm just thinking to myself, like, hey, I wonder if I fermented orange peels, if we could see a better translation of calcium being fed to the plants versus calcium that actually becomes deposited into the cell walls, right? Because it's one thing to just have it in the soil or to have it dissolved in your feed water. But it's another thing entirely when the plant starts taking it up and starts acting on the calcium in a way that makes it relevant for its both primary and secondary metabolic purposes. And some of the things that we've theorized and hypothesized in the past, we're now, through the good work that we're doing with our close friends, not only here in Washington, but certainly across the U.S., we have a number of people that are testing in a variety of different climates. And it's nice to start to see very consistent pieces of feedback come in, not only anecdotally in terms of what the growers are seeing. Some of these differences are like, hey, my plants are drinking 20 to 50% more water. Even though I'm in peat, it drinks faster than the comparable setup in rock wool. I mean, plants literally go through wet dry cycles that fast as a result of the way that our products work. But also on the test results themselves, we see fractions of terpenes and particularly farnesene is one example of a terpene that typically we don't see very high concentrations of until people start using our products. And then all of a sudden it just becomes almost a dominant terpene in some cases.
Farnesene.
Yeah. It's a sesquiterpene that's produced. Kind of gives like jasmine flowers their floral aroma. It's also involved in the aromatic profile of apples. So a lot of times it's kind of like this sweet, fruity, floral kind of thing. And there's a very good reason why that occurs. It has to do with the way that our products work. But, you know, to kind of answer your question more directly, there's effectively two halves of what we're doing. One is this advanced approach to looking at carbon like a macronutrient. This is where the advanced chemistry comes in. We're starting to actually look at individual elements, individual atoms of carbon, and figure out how to fit them within the dynamics of these plant engines, both primary and secondary metabolism. And then on the flip side, totally opposite, but still dovetailing and perfect, it's this like leopard skin loincloth wearing jungle shaman that's using four dozen species of plants and their extracts to create this holistic nutrient profile. So we do work with four dozen species roughly of plants. There's, you know, three quarters of them are terrestrial plants. A quarter of them are aquatic plants. We've got red kelp, green kelp, brown kelp, single-celled algae, all of which we're extracting in-house. We have very specific portions of plants, like we're using a organic matcha that's produced in the Uji region of Japan, very high quality matcha, but it's just the powdered green tea leaf. In some cases, we're using just the orange peel, for example, or when we're making silica skin, we use just the pistils of the safflower plant. And so they look like little strands of saffron. But, you know, the point I'm making here is that we're not using the whole plants. We're using very specific and isolated portions of the plants because those portions contain very valuable compounds for us. And the idea basically here is that these plants have been used for thousands of years already for a variety of different reasons, everything from pharmaceutical and therapeutic all the way to industrial and textile applications. In some cases, these plants have been used for over 6,000 years. And so we understand that they have this longstanding history with humans for a very long time. And what we're trying to do is repurpose the compounds that they produce into the context of agriculture. We're asking this question of, hey, we know this is a plant-based medicine. It's been used as medicine for thousands of years to heal the human nervous system. I wonder if there's some analogy, some metaphorical equivalent that we can make. Maybe instead of just healing the human body and the human nervous system, I wonder if we can heal damaged and degraded soils, or I wonder if we can improve the quality of life for all of the soil microorganisms, macroorganisms such as worms, leading all the way up the food chain to the human that consumes the flower at the very end of the of the cycle. So there's definitely this like plant-based approach that we're taking, and the use of all these plant extracts, I feel, allows us to create a chemical environment that is significantly richer than any living soil that's ever been present anywhere on Earth. I mean, most of the living soil blends out there, they'll have maybe 12 to 15 ingredients. Most of them are animal byproducts. We don't use any animal byproducts at all. You can give us a clean slate of just peat and perlite, maybe with a little bit of cocoa mixed in. And after one full round of using our products, that is now a living soil with dozens of species of microbes, with the perfect physical and chemical properties. And it has this very rich orchestra of plant extracts. You have all of these different compounds produced by so many different species of plants that would never be found in nature, but they yet here they are inside of this soil. So of course the plants will respond to it as they grow through the soil. They find the ginkgo leaf, they find the jasmine, they find stevia extract, they find hibiscus, green, they find all of these compounds, the licorice root extract that is in our root anchor.
It's a very diverse like genome of plants. Wild. And
some of these plants have different purposes, like the licorice root that we extract, we're bringing in whole and we're extracting it. Licorice roots, as it turns out, produce saponins. And for those of you who are familiar with surfactants or with saponins, you may be familiar with like yucca and quilaja. These are some of the more common saponins that are used, but even some of the synthetic surfactants, they effectively just modify the way that, you know, oxygen behaves, and also water specifically. They have a tendency to make water wetter, quote unquote, as it's described. But what we figured out was licorice roots also have saponins. These saponins, due to their molecular structure, can actually capture huge amounts of oxygen inside of their molecular framework. So when we water in this licorice root extract, it delivers dissolved oxygen to root hairs, which is fantastic for the operation of the roots because they behave just like human lungs. They need oxygen in order to breathe and to run their metabolic activities. What we also found about this licorice root, which I find very interesting, is that it's an incredibly powerful stimulant for beneficial fungi. So we used to put fungi, mycorrhizal fungi, inside of root anchor, but we eventually cut it out entirely because we noticed that licorice root is such a powerful biostimulant for fungi that whatever fungi you naturally have present either in your soil or in your air, in the surrounding environment, those fungi become so stimulated that easily within 24 to 48 hours, you'll see the mycelial networks literally explode in the soil. You'll see these white fuzzy hairs growing all through the medium, and then the fruiting bodies pop up. Within 48 to 72 hours, we've seen the fruiting bodies of these mushrooms just explode out of the soil, which is fantastic sign of balanced living soil chemistry. It's very healthy.
Holy cow. That's insanely fast.
That's so cool. When I'm hearing you talk about this, and you talked about your background, like you didn't come from a chemistry background. You were just passionate about this. Am I right? Or did you go to college or all these other things, or kind of take us through that? Cause it sounds like based on your history and what led up to Rooted, it's almost like it was always meant to be, because it just, everything fit into place. I could imagine your R&D time to develop your products you have now was not as long as many other ones, because you already have this background with fermentation and industrial chemistry. Like, how did you get into this?
Yeah, it's a personal passion of mine. I did go to college, but I didn't graduate, so I dropped out. In hindsight, it's always 2020. I probably would go back and finish, you know, an advanced degree nowadays if I could. But back then, I was just really excited about the opportunity to start a business. And I specifically dropped out of college to pursue the kombucha brewery itself. You know, never really got too big. At most, I was making probably, you know, 55 gallons a week of kombucha, which for most people, it's, you know, quite a lot. In the grand scale of you know, where kombucha is at right now, 55 gallons a week isn't really that much. But it still gave me an opportunity to, you know, be my own business owner, be an entrepreneur, learn from my mistakes. I learned a lot from that one experience. And then certainly as I moved forward through the industrial, you know, chemistry, I kind of took what I learned from kombucha, applied it to that business, learned a lot more. And now I'm applying everything to this business. And, you know, we're doing really well. The formulations themselves are based on a kind of chemistry that not a lot of people even know exists or even understand its relevancy in agriculture. So we had to come up with these manufacturing processes from scratch. We don't have any toll blenders. We didn't pay anyone to come in and formulate these products for us. This is entirely from scratch. This is kind of like my intellectual brainchild, if you will. And over the years, we've been refining the way that these products are made. And along the way, we've hired some chemical engineers to come in just to review the processes and give us their input as far as like which equipment, you know, pieces would be best, what hardware would be best for us to continue scaling this process up. And every single time we bring somebody in, they always scratch their head and they're like, there's no way this is going to work. Like, there's no way you guys are actually making this. It's impossible. And I just, you know, kind of look at them and I say, well, buckle up. What you know to be true about standard chemistry, industrial chemistry, is perhaps just one perspective, one way of looking at things. And if you change your perspective and look at things from a slightly different way, you can start to build out a process by which the creation of these types of products is in fact possible to achieve. That's kind of where we're at right now.
So with that, can you go back and when you really saw this take shape and saw the difference, like where you've got these chemists, these classically trained, and I'll call them classically trained chemists because they've been given these walls, like this is the bounds that you can travel in and you can't really go outside of it because this is what academia has said. And these are the practices we use throughout any, you know, other type of company. When you change that up and just start going, oh, you know, I'm going to use my background in fermentation. Like, what if we did this? Like, it wasn't like, this is the way. You're like, nah, that entrepreneurial side said, but can we do it differently? One of your first experiences of seeing, you know, let's take a cannabis plant. Like, when you saw that, I mean, what was that like for you to be able to just absolute excitement for you and for somebody who's growing it and they're looking at it going, holy shit, this is nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of aha moment came with a very early version of Solar Rain, which is our foliar spray. It's a magnesium based foliar spray. And initially at the time, what I was trying to do was create a form of magnesium that could fit directly into chlorophyll biosynthesis. So there are 7 or 8 steps involved in chlorophyll biosynthesis. And one of those steps involves the insertion of the magnesium ion into the porphyrin ring that sits at the dead center of chlorophyll. So this is the actual part of the chlorophyll molecule that absorbs photon energy and becomes excited, thus initiating the electron transport chain. It's magnesium that's tethered in the dead center of this. The photons hit the magnesium ion, and then that's where all the beauty and magic happens. So I was just trying to rack my brain because I was looking at all the ingredients and I saw magnesium sulfate and magnesium phosphate and magnesium nitrate. And that's not at all how plants work. There's just so many steps in between those forms, which are in the conventional fertilizers, and the final form factor that plants utilize magnesium in, that to me, it indicated the gap or the distance between the two needed to be closed a little bit so that we could create a product that was more digestible for the plants, more biologically relevant for them. And the aha moment came when we did foliar sprays of a very early version of Solar Rain and noticed that the plants respond within a matter of minutes. I mean, the response we know nowadays happens instantly because the chelates are so small that they can freely pass through cell walls. All of the chelates that we make, they're less than 10 carbon atoms long. These are like high octane race fuel that gets injected directly into the sites of primary metabolism. The moment that plants get them, they begin using them. The gene expression starts to become upregulated. More chlorophyll can be made. And within a matter of minutes, you'll see a noticeable change. I always tell people, I always challenge people, pick a plant that doesn't look so healthy. Find the one that's off from the corner, a little bit yellow, not drinking too fast. Give it a spray of Solar Rain. And I can't tell you how many times people have come back that following day and looked at that plant and thought to themselves, there's no way this is the same plant. There's just no way.
That this that's is insane. Same well, I have a quick question then, because you might have an idea. I have plants around my house, and I get every once in a while when I buy a plant from the store, it has gnats, and then they will spread and fuck all my other plants. Is there a product of yours that works really well for that?
Yeah, you know, most of the products, they're designed in such a way to deliver carbon that strengthens the immune system. So we're not trying to impart we're not trying to override what the plant naturally wants to do. Yeah. So if you give your plants, depending on the species of plant, whether it's a house plant or a cannabis plant or
they're
anything like
plants.
That. Yeah. So these various house plants, they've all got different molecular strategies, if you will, for how to defend and ward off certain disease pressures. Fungus gnats may be a little bit more benign than something like aphids or mites. But there's still a little bit of a nuisance for the plants. And so when you give our products to those plants, they're going to take that excess carbon and find an outlet for it in the form of that secondary metabolite. So they'll effectively end up creating their own mechanism or their own pathway to better resist the fungus gnats. And in most cases, what we find when you can't get rid of the actual fungus gnats, the plants end up establishing an equilibrium where they're not affected by the presence of the fungus gnats at all. There's no loss in the rate at which they grow. There's no loss in the compounds that they accumulate. They just literally are capable of dealing with them with no tax or draining of the energy.
Yeah. Because it's not, they have enough added energy from the extra compounds that are in that carbon that they're not being really hurt. Like you said, that energy tax isn't being used for fighting off that.
Yeah, and we have seen certain cases, this is true of some of the terpene test results that we get back from customers. Cannabis plants naturally produce a terpene called neralidol, and it's specifically for thrips. So when your garden is full of thrips, you know, thrips, if I had to pick one bug to have in my garden, it'd probably be thrips. They're very benign. They kind of just mess with the leaves. You know, they're kind of there without really damaging the plants in a, you know, very significant way. But what I've seen over the years is that the concentration of neralidol produced by plants is sort of proportionate to the concentration of thrips and whiteflies that exist on the leaf surface. And, you know, that's an example of where you give your plants more carbon, they'll naturally produce more neralidol because they understand through their plant receptor systems that they have thrips that they need to deal with. Whereas if you had a fungal infection like downy mildew or powdery mildew, instead of neralidol being produced, you might find the plants produce more limonene, because limonene is a compound that exhibits phase toxicity to the exoskeletons of bugs and also to the cell walls of fungi. So when they understand that they're being attacked by that, they specifically try to upregulate the biosynthesis of this terpene versus that terpene. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
That's incredible. Because, yeah, the plant's really just utilizing those nutrients to go, hey, I need to fight this, or I need this because this is what is dependent on, like, my environment is having this. So it sounds like the plant, if it has the ability and the energy, is incredibly smart on its own and can almost self-fight these if it has the initial health and, you know, energy, nutrients and fertilizer that it needs to kind of combat that.
It's naturally exactly what you said. I mean, if it has the right nutrient, the way that I mean, I'm hearing this, it's the same
it's like
as our
human
body.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because if we have the right nutrients, we have the right, if our homeostasis is where it needs to be, it's able to fight off bugs. Like,
yeah.
You don't think about that. Look, a typical layperson's not thinking about that with their plants, right? Going, oh yeah, if it had better nutrients, if it had more carbon, then it's able to produce these terpenes, and the terpenes are like these defensive, the being able to help strengthen it and being able to repel certain things or bring in more things. Like, that's just, it's amazing how that works. The blown away, just spraying it on and noticing within
where he was like, oh, you can notice
that
change in coloration,
like,
or like
crazy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like a person, right? You give them, if you give them something really, really healthy, you can see it in their, almost their pigment of their skin. Like, I feel better. They look better. So that just goes to say with growers within the cannabis, I mean, that you're on pretty good scale. You're all over the U.S. right now. Is that right?
Yep.
Are you outside of the U.S. or is it just a U.S. product currently?
We have customers in Mexico and in Canada, and we're looking at doing some more international business.
We are a global show. We are heard all over the world.
Yeah,
so
we're
in
86 different countries in the top 10. So
we were just curious.
It just sounds like such a, I mean, literally, like Brandon says, it's like a miracle, this miracle nutrient that.
It makes so much more sense, because even when I studied that handbook for growers, it went more into like the balance, the ratio and that, but understanding the process of where so much of its purpose is to convert most of that back to carbon. Well, if you can provide it with those nutrients and things in the first place, it's not going to go through all these extra steps and try and fight this stuff or do this. Like, it's going to just have so much, basically food or fuel to grow into the best possible plant. Like, this seems like such a more direct method than even the approach that I read and studied in that entire handbook.
When you get more out of your yield, I mean, you think about all of these growers out there, and I'm sure you know this too, not all growers are equal. You've got some ones that have the staff, the knowledge to be able to understand some elements of what you've discussed, but from being able to have it where it's all a product, it's all in one, it's designed specifically for this and things that weren't even thought of before. This is going to be able to help a lot of those growers producing.
Or even home grow. You think about if you're growing your own medicine at home and you're wanting to have the best yield, the highest quality product, the best entourage effect, because you've got the widest terpenes, cannabinoids, and it's taking out so much of that work. You're not worrying about, oh crap, I need to worry about all these. Okay, well, if your plant, like you said, has all of this like ideal stuff, all of this energy in this bank, well, it's not having to go, hey, I don't have energy for this. 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 It's going to that bank going, hey, I've got energy for this. I've got energy for this. Oh, sweet. Let's build this new addition. Oh, let's do this. Like, I've got energy for days. And I imagine this plant just being so much, like a million times better. It's like the crap. If you're putting fast food in your body every day versus, honestly, yeah, it might suck and it might be a pain in the ass to figure out, but like, a whole food diet, like I'm sure your body feels a million times better.
Well, and what I really like is, you know, on their website, when you're thinking about that, if it is a home grow, you can get a quart. If you're doing commercial, you're going up to 5 gallons. The prices are extremely reasonable.
Or even reach out to him if you need larger than that. I'm sure they have larger than that options that they can work with.
That's great. Yep. You think about all of those types of growers. That I am so glad that you hit on that, Brandon. It's, you know, your home growers, you know, who knows what they do. If you're being able to produce and you're able to follow a great process.
Well, it's every grower. It was when we invested in that and realizing it wasn't just the grower. Like that founder wasn't the grower. He had a separate grower. So we had two guys who were there who were supposed to be experts in it. And yet when I went and read one book, past my knowledge at that moment, none of the things that I asked, they understood. None of the things I asked, they knew. And yet they could take something as simple as your fertilizer, and you can take the average Tom, Dick, Harry, and turn it into an amazing grow. You're no longer having this Charlie Brown Christmas tree looking fuck in the corner growing. Yep. You're like, man, I hope this gets me high. I hope this does what I want it to. Mm-hmm. No, you're over there like, I'm not sure I would smoke that. Like, you probably shouldn't consume that.
Well, I think about it. I'm actually really jealous. And I'm just like, I wish I knew more growers, you know, or even locally here, or those that we frequent are using this product.
Yeah.
I mean, I am seriously blown away here, Nick.
So tell us, Nick, how can everyone find Rooted Leaf? How can they get in touch with you? How can our audience get in contact to check you out?
Check us out on Instagram, The Rooted Leaf. And if you send us a message, I'm usually the person that responds. So I always encourage people, if you have questions or if you want to learn a little bit more, don't hesitate to ask. You know, we're all in this together, and the better you can understand something, the better we all do as a community and kind of push things forward. I do want to mention real quick too, the benefit for home growers primarily is that there's no longer a need to supplement CO2. If you're in a home grow environment, you can crank up the light intensity by turning a dial, and you can give extra fuel to your plants by simply watering them a little bit more. The hard part for home growers has always been, how do I increase the concentration of carbon available to the plants? Because that requires a sealed room. Yeah. Now you have very expensive build out. You've got air conditioners and dehumidifiers. It becomes a little bit too much for a home grower. But if you can fit the equivalent of 5,000 ppm of CO2 into the feed water, your home grower will go from small 12 to 24 inch plants to 5 foot, 6 foot tall plants. You'll shave the veg time in half.
Yeah.
You'll save 2 weeks on bloom. And you'll get twice as much yield with an increase in the overall quality. A lot of the home growers, they really like the fact that you do not have to adjust the pH of our products. It does come out acidic. I'm not saying it's a pH perfect, like it's always going to be 5.8. We have growers using RO water. The feed water mixture comes out to a pH of 4.0, which is incredibly low. It's very, very acidic. But that's 100% safe to apply to the plants. You do not have to adjust the pH whatsoever. In fact, we encourage people to not adjust the pH specifically because of the way that our carbon-based chelates work. They operate very, very efficiently at extremely low pHs, and the nutrients themselves remain soluble from a pH range as low as it goes, maybe 3.5, 4.0 on the low end, all the way up to about 8.5. We never see the feed water mixture come out that high, but you know, over time, as we've run bench tests and stability tests, we've noticed that all of the chelates, they're capable of maintaining those elements in a true solution, meaning there's no adverse chemistries, in that full pH range, 4.0 all the way up to about 8.0, 8.5. Everything is 100% available to the plant. So you just mix it up, don't aerate it, don't adjust the pH, just mix it up and water it to the plants and they're good to go.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you know, people have questions, definitely reach out on Instagram.
Yeah, we'll have the links below. We'll have his website and the Instagram below too.
Yeah, and I am blown away. Like, I'm literally so blown away, because what you've ultimately done is you have made it easier for anybody to be able to grow high yield anything.
And better quality.
Better quality. I'm just, you know, when you're describing these little tiny little plants that they'll grow, like I remember your little hemp plant that you grew in the backyard. And that thing was tiny. And
the problem was, if I had used his, it wouldn't have been discreet. It would have been over the wall and everyone would have seen it.
That's so cool. So it's like, it's super fuel, dude. It's seriously, it like makes it a mutant in it's the incredible. Best way possible. It's so, I know enough about it, but just to hear it from you, and especially really appreciating that it came from a passion, like not only on the business side, but you're passionate about it through kombucha that got you to this point. And it's not saying like, well, that can't be done, going, what else could we do from what I already know? What else can I apply to it? And you have such a wide range of different products that are specific for different types of whatever you're trying to be able to accomplish with your grow. I would just be, I could see a massive, when I'm thinking on the commercial grow side, I'm thinking amount of extra cost that's being able to be reduced just by utilizing this.
Massive. Like even the talk of carbon alone, like what is the cost of going and buying all of these carbon, like buying all of that carbon,
well, and
excess
maintaining
carbon,
all that and everything else.
How many outdoor grows can become almost as good as some of these indoor grows, even just because it's so hard. Like that is a really tough thing to do outside, is to increase that carbon amount or like the plants need to get, because like in a sealed indoor environment, you can increase the light, you can increase the, you know, you can increase all of that. You don't have any way to manipulate the sun. You don't have any way to manipulate that. So it's way harder to introduce like that carbon based thing, but in their fertilizer, that becomes this incredible source to just like get almost indoor quality grows from, even outdoor grows or at home grows. Like you said, most people at home aren't having a totally sealed environment that they're, hey, I've got this enclosed area, I've got, and they know, here's my CO2 levels, here's my, like, they're not measuring those. They have no clue. Most of them have no idea.
Yeah, this is the reason why we wanted to bring you on, because we just,
and I didn't even understand it to this level. So this has been incredible, because it really opens the door for every cannabis grower or those who are even on the fence about, man, you know, I've really been nervous to try growing because I don't want to screw it up. I don't want to waste and have all this time that in it, it doesn't turn out. Okay, well, if you can start from scratch with a fertilizer to give that plant like the best suited option to grow the best plant, like that's going to be your best thing. You can grow that at home. You could grow that commercial grade. You could do whatever scale that you're doing with that and take it to the better, like you're growing such better quality. How many dispensaries have we gone to that it's like,
Well, you can tell a difference with the bud. I mean, you can tell if it's really been well cared for. Like we've been able to receive some from up around your area to Oregon and NorCal, and just like, you really are able to appreciate when a cultivar has really taken that time. But that's a lot of time and understanding, and there's a lot of screw ups that go into there. You know, the one thing I would think, the gateway drug of using this for those that are watching or listening, get that solar rain. Just thinking about that. What if you have a plant right now that you're working with, maybe you got like 5 or 6 or way more than that, getting just starting out with solar rain and say, look, I just want to see this. Like, I'm really want to test that. I guarantee right from that point, that trigger will go off.
Oh yeah.
You'll be right back on that side by and more. Cause it's really?
Yeah.
Well, oh.
Yeah.
It takes one time and you're sold.
Yeah. Particularly on the outdoor side, like you were talking about, carbon is always a limiting factor for plants growing out there. So a lot of times when we do our side by sides, it's not an incremental difference. It's not like a 10% gain or a 15% gain. You know, on the one hand, with the salt-based fertilizers, you have plants that end up being about 4 to 6 feet tall. And then directly next to them, you know, same environment, basically, with our products, those same strains taken off the same mom at the same time, they're 12 to 14 feet tall. And I always try to stress to people that it's impossible, unless you have a trained understanding, a really deep and thorough understanding of how to identify a carbon deficiency in a plant. Because if you give your plants more carbon and they end up producing more terpenes and more cannabinoids, it's a sign that the plant was deficient in carbon. Just like if your plants are yellow and you give them more nitrogen and they green back up, you know the plants were deficient in nitrogen. That visual feedback loop is not possible to achieve with carbon, because you can't look at those plants. You can't look at a test result and say, God, you know, I only tested at 4% terpenes. It's a sign of a carbon deficiency. I could have tested at 5% terpenes. Most growers don't know enough about the inner workings of carbon metabolism to actually see that. So the benefit with our products is we can hardwire, you know, just like an axle connects two wheels, through the use of our products, we hardwire the air and the fuel together, so that when you increase the fuel rate, you can also increase the air, the concentration of carbon available for those plants. This creates an equilibrium between the two of them. And the only thing you really have to do is just change up the light intensity, make it more intense. And if the plants are a little bit thirstier, give them a little bit more water. Everything else underneath that within the system is hardwired and linked to the delivery of both the carbon the plants are ultimately ineffably obsessed with. They're even more obsessed than we are with carbon somehow. And they also utilize all of these elements specifically for that purpose. It's a little bit, you know, it's interesting because I feel like through this discussion, we've actually just kind of scratched the surface, if you will. Yeah, we haven't even actually looked at the list, the analogy of how nitrogen relates to an engine mount, or how phosphorus is like the battery in a superconductor, or maybe magnesium is like a specialized spark plug in all of these engines. Those are kind of the more inner layers of this analogy that we've been refining over time. And really, as we've learned about how the products work, we're capable of creating these analogies and having people better understand what exactly is going on, so that they too, even if they're just the average home grower, that they can hit 3 to 4 pounds per 1,000 watts, which we see quite often at this point, above 6% terpenes on dry flower, no problem for a home grower. It's the type of stuff that,
hell yeah,
you know, any commercial grower would have to spend millions of dollars to actually properly build out. And, you know, like we were talking about earlier, solar rain was kind of that first aha moment. And there was this underlying theory that we had about how solar rain operated and what the specific mechanism was, which then ended up flowing out into the rest of the product line to be developed and designed. And now all of the products that we make, it's like one holistic system that represents a carbon-centric approach to plant fertilizer, and maybe more specifically from the individual perspective of how those elements get metabolized and how they're processed by plants, all in an attempt to capture carbon, to store it, or to move it around and utilize it somehow. So there's definitely something. And I do want to mention too, we created a coupon code for the listeners. If they use the coupon code Cannabis School, all one word, it'll get them 20% off.
Dude.
Oh, Nick, you're
thank you, man.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Oh, dude, oh, yeah. That is so...
You guys are welcome.
Oh, man, this is so cool. Okay, so go to rootedleaf.com. You know, for anybody, honestly, after listening to this, this is probably by far the most exciting conversation that we have ever had about nutrients in the soil. Like we had a guy we knew, he's an ethnobotanist.
And he has his own living soil that he's created here. He sells it around and that.
But it's nowhere comp. It's nowhere.
Not
it doesn't
on this level.
Not even close.
And I've known this guy since I was in elementary school. And yeah. I've never had this
and
level of
conversation.
He's
the smartest guy in the world.
Him.
Just ask him. But you know, but seriously, we love this. It just, you have made this such a complex idea of what plants actually do when they use the water, the sunlight, and the nutrients in the soil to such a magical place. Like, honestly, I say that wholeheartedly. This is magical. if you are a home grower, I mean, you got to get solar rain. Just give it a shot. Put it on your plant and see that. And then that's just going to get you addicted to the rest of the line. If you're a commercial grower, you need to be looking at this.
Oh,
think
gosh.
About the reduction in cost as far as everything else that goes in there, and then the margins that you have.
Well, and quality.
And thinking down to the dollar price, like the yield, as far as what you get, the margins, I know you guys are operating in a thinner margin. How would you like to expand that one by being able to reduce your cost with your actual production?
If you increase yield and decrease costs, that is also increasing your margins. That's like a no-brainer,
But just to be able to watch, I mean, hearing that, right? Solar rain is just like that.
That's cool.
That's that conversion moment, right? That's the baptism. Yeah. Like, it's awesome.
Yeah, and there's layers to the experience of cannabis flower that I feel like are being removed in the pursuit of this very, very large recreational industry that's nationwide. Mm-hmm. You know, people are getting used to mediocre quality cannabis and they forget there's entire layers of the experience. One of them, which is most profound with our products, is the aftertaste. There's a very distinct, and it's not like a specific aftertaste that is present in every single strain, but certainly flower that's grown with our product line has a very, depending on the strain, it'll have a different aftertaste, but it's this very distinct and unique thing. And as soon as people identify that, they can start to compare that in some of the other examples of flower that they get, and they come back and they're like, you know what? That tastes like salt. I can actually taste the salts used in the environment.
I've actually heard really negative things about salt grown flowers. There's one of the content creators on social that we follow, and I had a discussion with her about it because she's out in, I think she's in Washington actually, and she was talking about like salt-based fertilizers and just even the experience in like a salt-based fertilizer flower versus like even an organic grown one without the salt-based fertilizers. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But it was actually more of like a negative experience even from the salt-based fertilizer. And so I'm just very, very blown away. Just, I mean, with the wide range of products that have come out, even for cannabis across the years, and even in the last 10, 20 years, how drastically it has changed. You know, I haven't heard of any negatives from what he's told us is in there.
No.
You know, and there's nothing in there that it's looking at and going,
it's magic sauce.
Yeah, that's literally what it's like. I'm like, oh, shit. It's like, you know, Space Jam, you got Magic Mike's special sauce or whatever. And
I don't know where you were going there, but I mean,
Space Jam? It's just,
No, but dude, I seriously agree with you that, like, it's just, it's that crazy to hear this from you because we've heard a lot of different things about soil and soil composition, especially when it comes to growing cannabis. This is the easiest and the most. You're just going to have a better experience,
I think, from what it sounds like. Yeah.
And particularly for people that are very used to certain strains, if you're familiar with a particular genetic, you've grown that cultivar for maybe a decade, 15 years. Every single time we've worked with people that have very old genetics, they're very comfortable with, very familiar with, they come back and they tell us not only are the growth characteristics like visibly different, it almost looks like an entirely different plant, but the quality of the smoke and the flower is dramatically different. You know, the smoke is so soft and smooth that you can barely even feel it going into your lungs. And in some cases, like with a Cushman strain that we grew just a few months ago, it had this distinct and overt cooling property, this cooling effect, because there was menthol there, which typically is not expressed in very high concentrations in cannabis. Yeah. For this particular pheno of Cushman's, it was very minty. And it had this combo of like citrus fruit, lime, lemon, coupled with this minty kind of wintergreen kind of flavor sensation. So you would inhale a joint or, you know, a bong or even a blunt. You couldn't even feel the smoke entering your lungs. And then when you exhale, this icy kind of sensation that's very soft
mentally
and relaxing. Yeah. It almost makes the lungs feel more expansive, like you can breathe more deeply as a direct result of this. Nobody's coughing. Nobody's like, oh, that's harsh. It's exactly the opposite. They take a hit, they exhale, and while the smoke is still billowing out of their mouth, they say, whoa, what is this?
Yeah, it's Nick, this needs to be sold to anyone who grows cannabis. Yeah, because if that's the experience of the end product, sold. I don't know why it's like this bong. This is the smoothest bong that we have ever tried. And I don't know why I would tell anyone else to buy any other bong or smoke out of any other bong ever.
Yeah.
because until I find something that is better, that is the best thing I have ever found. And it makes exactly the same sense, because you look at that and you go, okay, cool. You could get like half-ass subpar product, or you could grow like the best quality product. Which one are you going to pick?
Dude, this magic. Magic, because it makes me think about like the reason why we love this bond is the smoothest, most flavorful hits we've ever been able to receive from a bong. But to have flower that's been grown with that your way. Products
and then smoked out of that, I could just imagine, because this I'm is one jealous. That like it's really hard to so cough jealous. Yeah, it would be just the most amazing experience.
Oh, there's so much out of this. Okay, again, so we've got rootedleaf.com. You go promo code Cannabis School, 20%.
Yeah.
All one word. Go check them out. This is amazing. Nick, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for everyone at home.
Yeah, and tuning in. I think this is going to be an episode a lot of people are going to be listening to over and over and over, because this is absolutely a game changer for cannabis. I can't wait to be going to a local dispo and being able to try some of that. So thank you again, brother. Thank you so much. And
thank you guys. I appreciate the opportunity. And for everybody listening, thanks for taking the time. If you guys have questions, like I said, please follow us on Instagram, send us a message. I'm usually the person that responds, and I like to nerd out and talk in great level of detail here. I feel like we barely scratched the surface.
Oh,
You know, it's the Pandora's box of possibilities. This is an infinite world for us to keep exploring. So definitely over time, if you guys have questions, even if it's not right now, but in the future, feel free to reach out, and I'll help out as best I can.
All right.
We love you guys at home. Love all of our Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for helping us reach just another person like you.
All right. Hey, take care.